Hill. The amendment done
yes, you have to
send the Hill. It makes me worry.
Hi, my dear.
Hi, how are you?
Yeah.
Did you know the Good Wife's tragedy
ready?
Yet?
No.
I haven't been
watching. Ready?
So. Oh, you haven't?
No. I guess I should.
No sugar water?
Good afternoon. This is Health and Human Services and Housing on March 24th. We have a very busy agenda again. We are really excited that Senator Metzen hasn't joined us today. We don't see you here very often, Senator Metzen. We're so happy to see you here. We don't often get a chance to see you here in Health and Human Services.
Well, I don't know if that's good or bad, Madam Chair, but I'm happy to be here. Very happy to be
happy
here.
To have you here. You're presenting a pharmacy benefit manager contract regulations, specialty drug prescription designation requirements, some mail order prescription authority for retail community pharmacies, and some maximum allowable pricing limitations. And so with that, we know that there is an amendment to the bill. We do not yet have a quorum, but we'd like you to talk about the amendment and begin to describe the bill, and we'll take action when we have a quorum.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. You're absolutely correct. Senate File 2284 is a generic drug transparency bill. Was brought to my attention by my local family pharmacist. Primarily it deals with the disclosure of generic drug prices for all. This is a bipartisan bill, and I believe the bill with the amendment is non-controversial. I'm going to have Jeff Lindu, Vice President of Government.
We now have a quorum, so we can go ahead.
Yeah, maybe we should put the amendment on. If somebody would be so kind to
move the A1. Senator Lori moves the A1 delete all amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say nay. Okay, well, please proceed.
Thank you very much. Again, I say this has been worked out, I believe, with the all concerned. We think it gives a little light on the subject of transparency on billing. And with me is Jeff Lindu.
We should note for the record that we did have a quorum, actually, by the time we took that vote. Did you say that for the record?
Yes, I did say we had a quorum.
Good.
He's with the Thrifty White Pharmacy to further explain the bill as amended. Thank you, Senator.
Thank you, Senator. Senator Sharon, members of the committee, again, my name is Jeff Lindu with Thrifty White Pharmacies and with the Minnesota Pharmacists Association. The language that's before you today does represent the outcome of working with all of the stakeholders in this bill. It deals primarily with generic pricing. It does require pharmacy benefit managers to provide at the beginning of each contract year information on the sources that they use for establishing their generic prices. Allows the pharmacies access to current generic drug prices for all of the pharmacy benefit managers, assures that when the PBM establishes a generic price that the product is available in the marketplace. There is a process in language in the bill to require a process to appeal the generic drug price. There is a 15-day limit, business day limit, for the pharmacy to file an appeal from the time of a contested claim, and the PBM has to resolve that within 7 days. And if the PBM denies the claim, they do have to provide identification of the product in the marketplace that is available at the price that they have set. And if the appeal is successful, then they have 1 day to establish that price. And I think with that very brief explanation, I will just open it up to questions.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions for the testifier? Senator Lori.
Well, one question would be, it's not entirely clear whether this would have any fiscal implications. I guess I'd like to, I don't know what the intent of the author is, whether it would go to the Finance Committee for review of that.
I don't think so. I haven't heard from Madam Chair.
I guess I'd like to maybe ask if DHS is here and can come confirm.
Is anyone here from DHS?
If not,
we can lay it on the table until we figure that out.
Senator Lori, we have spoken extensively with Sarah Drake over at DHS, And she was one of the stakeholders that we were working with through that, and she has indicated that there would not be a fiscal impact. We have also visited with MMB, and they have indicated the same.
Is there anyone here that can actually... We'd
like to try to actually
get them up to the table to do that. I mean, I'd like to... Maybe that...
That will be...
Out there, we can have somebody...
I'm from a different area of DHS, so
okay.
I don't know if that's helpful.
Well, if you
are you able to answer the question?
No.
Okay, then it will not be helpful. Thank you very much. Listen,
Madam Chair, the good pharmacist here has indicated that he has met with them and that there is no. So if you find out something different later, but I would hope you would move this and include it in. And if we find out something different, you've got time, I think, with the major
to
bill
re-refer
to delete it if there's a problem. But I've been told, and so is our witness, that there is no fiscal.
We have a couple of options here. We could lay it now until we get somebody to come in and speak to the committee now. We're here for a while. If there aren't any other further objections, or we can pass it and have it re-referred to finance if that's necessary. What is your preference, Senator Lori?
Well, my preference, I'm a co-author on the bill, I see. So, I mean, I can present it, and if we wanted to lay it on the table, I'm quite sure we could get certainty around this before we closed today. So maybe we lay it on the table and pick up the proper motion.
Madam Chair, I might add that Senator Lori is right. We have some wonderful authors of the bill. Senator Rosen, Senator Lori, and Kaselka. Yeah, so anyway, yeah, we thought we'd mention some of those names. But anyway, that's fine. Just so
Thanks.
We can get it out today.
We'll make a motion a little later on.
Yeah. May I just make sure before we go that is there anybody that has any questions here? Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on this bill at this time? So it doesn't look like I think people are supportive of the bill, Senator Mensah. I don't think you really need to come back either. So we'll just lay it on the table and make sure we get somebody from DHS to confirm that there is not a fiscal note, and then we can act on it.
Madam Chair, members, that's fair.
Okay. So we'll lay it on the table. Thank you very much, Senator Mensah.
Thank you.
Eaton's bill. So next is Senator Eaton, Senate File 1864. She's waiting. Yeah, I just thought I'd bring my own over to. Where are any other Senator Eaton is presenting the Mental Health Crisis Intervention and Stabilization Services Provisions Modifications.
Madam Chair, yes, Senate File 1864 is what you have stated, and I do have an A1 amendment.
There's an A1 amendment. Do we have that?
Yep.
Oh, yeah, we do.
It's not very life-changing.
Senator Eaton moves to amend Senate File Number 1864 with the A1 amendment. This is the first stop, an author's amendment. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed?
Thank you. I think first I'll just give you an overview, and then I'll let Ms. Aberholden go into detail. Basically, this is a bill that helps with identifying and treating mental illnesses early, and that's an effective strategy in terms of cost, but more importantly in terms of how the individual lives with their illness. We have a mobile crisis teams around the state, though not in every county. We want to clarify these teams can go out and work to engage people voluntarily in treatment. They don't have to wait until there's a full-blown emergency and the person meets the criteria for commitment or hospitalization. This is not occurring, and This bill will encourage that.
Ms. Abderholden, please introduce yourself for the record.
Madam Chair, members Sue Abderholden, Executive Director of NAMI Minnesota. I am sure that each and every one of you have received a call from a constituent whose loved one was experiencing serious symptoms of a mental illness, and they were desperate. They saw their loved one decompensating, but there was nothing that they could do. They didn't yet meet hospital level of care or the criteria in the Commitment Act. Imagine how painful it must be to watch someone you love become sicker each passing day or hour, and you are totally helpless. NAMI receives these calls every week, and it's heartbreaking. This bill will change this scenario. Currently, the law governing crisis teams differentiates between an emergency and a crisis, but for all intents and purposes, they don't. Imagine calling 911 because your loved one is having chest pains. Would they say, call us back when you're sure your loved one is having a heart attack? Of course not, but that is, in essence, what our crisis teams do. Under this bill, we are promoting identifying and treating mental illnesses early. A good mental health professional or practitioner can go out multiple times to develop a level of trust and engage the person in obtaining voluntary treatment. They will work with the family, educating and supporting them during this difficult time. The teams will engage peer specialists, people who live with a mental illness, who are in recovery and have received specialized training, who can also try to convince the person to accept treatment. The teams will be required to actually listen to families, and we are often the canary in the coal mine and know when these symptoms are beginning to return. The bill also underscores the importance of an advanced psychiatric directive, and teams will be encouraged to work with the person to develop one. In addition, ensuring what I like to call a warm handoff is important. Giving someone a piece of paper with a number to call when the symptoms of their mental illness is interfering with their ability to concentrate and follow through on tasks doesn't make much sense. We need to make sure that they become connected to the right people and the right providers. And this is not to criticize our crisis teams at all, but this is a fairly new service in Minnesota, and now that we've had several years of experience, it's time to make changes and strengthen them. We don't yet know the fiscal cost, but we do know that overall crisis teams have saved money by preventing hospitalizations. Intervening earlier can only save even more money. Grace Tangard-Schmidt with Guild Incorporated could not be here this morning, but I just wanted to share a story that she actually shared in the House hearing. She has a client, John, and his mom, Stella. And when they met John, he was living in the woods. He had lost his wife, his daughter, his home, and his job, all related to untreated schizoaffective disorder and an untreated substance use disorder. They had reached out to him, and they began working together. He moved from being homeless to being housed, from untreated mental illness to well-treated mental illness, from untreated substance use disorder to sobriety, from unemployment to full-time employment. He was laid off, however, when his employer moved his business out of state. And then his health began to change. Guild had stepped up the frequency of their contacts to 2 and 3 times a week, and his team thought that things were under control. Then his mother, Stella, called Julie, the team leader, and she said, Julie, it's bad. It was like it was before he started with you. Julie listened carefully. John's mother was seeing very early signs of deteriorating health. The signs she saw were too subtle for them to even see, even though they had worked with him for 6 years. So they stepped up their contacts. Bottom line is they were able to intervene early enough and with success that John didn't lose his home and commitment for involuntary treatment was avoided. Today his health is stable and he's again working full time. I really urge your support for this important bill. Let's make sure that families aren't placed in the impossible situation of watching a loved one decompensate to the point that they meet the criteria, Commitment Act criteria. We need to promote early and voluntary treatment. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Senator Eaton, did you have...
Yeah, I was just going to quickly run through the bill. Section 1 adds ACT teams, crisis stabilization, partial hospitalization to the types of community programs that can be used under Minnesota's early intervention law under the Commitment Act. And Section 2 clarifies that peer support specialists can be used on mobile crisis teams. Section 3 clarifies that they can assess whether the person might be willing to accept treatment voluntarily, checks to see if they have an advance directive, takes down information from the family or caretakers, and allows the team to provide family psychoeducation so they know how to help their loved one. Section 4 stresses the skills of treatment engagement strategies and working with families. And Section 5 ensures there's a warm handoff, as spoke about, and the crisis team work on a developing an advance directive. And then Section 6 adds an advance directive to the person's file if they have one. Are there any questions?
Committee members, do you have any questions regarding the bill?
Madam Chair?
Oh, Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question about, I know that Ms. Abderholden and I had discussed this previously, and I think it was perhaps this bill that would have provided a remedy. When someone has this, as you said, we see them decompensating, they need some care but don't want to go in. Sometimes they try to self-medicate through things like alcohol, other things. And my question is, I was told earlier that if someone has been drinking, that the mobile crisis teams cannot help them, even though there's clearly a need for some mental health intervention. And I want to know, one, if I was given accurate information, and if that truly is the case, is there something in this bill that would allow mobile crisis units to intervene and help, even though someone has been trying to self-medicate with alcohol?
Ms. Abderholden?
Madam Chair, Senator Nelson, there is nothing in our current statute that says that they can't go out when that is happening. Now, if the person reaches the level of needing detox, you know, then that becomes a different system. But just because they've been drinking or, you know, maybe using some other illegal drugs does not mean the crisis team can't go out. It's so frequent, frankly, that, you know, the two are combined because people do self-medicate. And again, there's nothing in the statutes that says that they can't. If we, you know, need to add a phrase in there, I'm perfectly willing to do that because I don't think that's right. The crisis team needs to go out when both things are going on.
Thank you. Madam Chair.
Senator Nelson.
I'd like to work with counsel to get that phrase to just clarify, because there obviously are some misunderstandings in the field. So I'm not sure where that would be, but perhaps counsel could help with that.
Thank you. And are you saying offline before it goes to finance or just now?
I think we should add the amendment now.
Okay. Do you have any suggestions, counsel? Okay.
Thank you.
Ms.
Abderholden.
Madam Chair, if I could suggest that perhaps adding to the definition of either mental health crisis or mental health emergency might be a way to put something in there if someone has a co-occurring substance use disorder. Something of that nature.
Thank you. Madam Chair, I'll get back with counsel on that.
I'm sorry, what line were you looking at, Ms. Abderholden? So I just so I know where you were.
2.9 or 2.10?
Madam Chair, maybe we can put this bill on hold. I think we should amend the definition of mental health mobile crisis intervention services because that's where you're having the issue. And maybe we can come back to the bill.
We'll lay this one on the table.
Okay.
So Senate file 1864 is laid on the table. And the next bill, Senate file 1865, Senator Eaton also, adult foster homes serving individuals with mental illness, staff training requirements clarification. Senator Eaton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I do believe I have an A1 amendment to this one also.
I don't believe I have the amendment. Okay, so the amendment is coming around. Senator Eaton, did you have any comments about the amendment, or do you want to just...
The amendment is the result of a lot of work with a lot of different stakeholders and kind of helped us find peace in the valley, as it were.
And this is an author's amendment also. This is the first committee.
Yes.
All those in favor of the author's amendment A1 for Senate File 1865, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Motion is adopted.
Thank you,
Senator Eaton.
Senate File 1865 is a bill. Well, back in 2012, we made changes to the adult foster care system to create a mental health certification program so that people knew which corporate foster care homes had staff training in mental illness and had access to at least a mental health practitioner. As this was being implemented, the mental health community discovered some problems. For instance, some people were offering the training, but the person conducting it didn't have a strong background in mental illness. In other situations, a home would send one person to the training, and then that person would go back and train everyone else. A work group was convened by DHS this fall, and it included county staff, providers, and advocates. They discussed the following topics: trainer qualifications, training competency measures, what each content area should include, when and how often direct care staff should receive training, and if the 12 hours of annual training required for adult foster care direct care staff can include the 7 hours of training required for adult foster care mental health certification. The bill before you has addresses most of these issues and a pretty good consensus from the group. The bill clarifies this section is for homes that serve people whose primary diagnosis is mental illness. It adds training on suicide warning signs and interventions, adds that there must be a crisis plan for each person, tightens up who can give the training. It must be a mental health professional or practitioner. It can also be a person who lives with a mental illness or family member if they are from a nonprofit approved by DHS to deliver the training and have a history of providing education on mental illness. Clarifies what components of the training people must have before they start working with the residents in the home, namely basic information on mental illness and de-escalation techniques.
Chair.
Ms. Abderholden.
Sue Abderholden, NAMI, Minnesota. I just want to remind people that the reason that we started this was because we had corporate foster homes that had people with serious mental illnesses in them that had no idea what to do when someone, you know, was having a mental health crisis. They didn't know de-escalation techniques. People ended up being picked up by police, you know, brought to the jail. So we had a lot of bad things that were happening. It's important to note that over 25% of the people who leave Anoka go to a corporate foster care setting. So you want to make sure that those folks are going into a setting where they actually have staff who are trained to do this. This is a voluntary certification. So foster homes do not have to do this. It's just if they want to do this and they want to get this little certificate that they can put on their wall saying, our staff have training on mental illnesses and we have crisis plans, then this is what they need to do. So I just want to make sure you know we're not adding things on to all the other foster homes. This is a voluntary way to do this. The mental health providers that we work with that run some of these corporate foster homes feel completely at home with this. They think it's important because they think their staff really should know how to de-escalate and should understand the signs of a crisis before they even deliver care to someone. Again, I think these are good clarifications. My staff actually just did a training on suicide prevention last week to some foster home providers, and he was amazed that, frankly, he said, you know, our staff didn't know how to respond when someone was suicidal, and we learned some very important techniques. So I think this just adds to the quality of the programming that we have for people who live with a serious mental illness, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Committee members, do you have any questions? Well, I see no questions being brought forward. Any other thoughts, Senator Eaton?
No, Madam Chair. I'd like to move the bill as amended. Is this a possible inclusion in the omnibus?
Correct, yes. This will be laid over. Senate File 1865. Senator Eaton moves to pass and lay over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Any other questions or discussion? All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any all those opposed? The motion passes. And are we...
Are we back to
Okay, the council is ready, so we will take Senate File 1864 off the table. And I believe, do you have a recommended amendment to propose?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Ms. White?
If you look at the bill 1864, page 2, after line 35, we're amending the Mental Health Mobile Crisis Intervention Services by adding a number 5, which reads, the team must be available to individuals who are experiencing co-occurring substance abuse issues. Period.
Thank you.
Senator Nelson?
Madam Chair, I believe that is the language that will accomplish what I've what I'm seeking, but I actually want to ask Ms. Abderholden to kind of weigh in on this amendment to make sure that it gets to the heart of what we discussed.
Ms. Abderholden.
Madam Chair, I believe it does. The only thing that you might want to add, just to clarify, is and for those who don't need the level of care provided in a detox setting, because they would not be qualified to go out and deal with that. It's much more of a health issue at that point.
Madam Chair, I would like to
Senator
add,
Nelson.
Thank you. I would like to add that into my amendment as well.
Ms. Wyatt, does that? Do you want to read back the entire amendment then?
Sure. And I might need to finesse it a little bit with Sue, but we'll get at least the idea. Number 5, the team must be available to individuals who are experiencing co-occurring substance abuse issues and who do not need the detoxification level of care.
Madam Chair,
Ms. Abderholden.
Ms. White, I think you would want to say substance use disorder instead of issue.
Disorder?
Okay. Yes.
Does everyone understand what the amendment says, or do you need it?
So I'd like to move that amendment, Madam Chair.
Senator Nelson moves the amendment. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
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 Any opposed? Motion passes. Now back to the bill.
As amended.
As amended. Any other questions or discussion? Seeing none, Senator Eaton moves to pass Senate File 1864 as amended and refer to Finance. Any other discussion? All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Any opposed? Motion passes. Next, we have Senate File 2510, Senator Rosen. Dental cone beam computerized tomography from diagnostic imaging requirements exemption.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and
Senator
members.
Rosen.
Thank you. Senate File 2510 is the, as you said, the cone beam CT imaging technology bill. So, but basically, right now, FDA views the cone beam computed tomography system, CBCT, let's call it that, as a variation of their traditional CT systems. CBCT rotates around the patient, capturing a data using a cone-shaped X-ray beam, which is then used to construct a three-dimensional image of the teeth in the jaw. In Minnesota Statutes 144.1225, the Advanced Diagnostic Imaging Services, it says by last year, August 1st, 2013, the Advanced Diagnostic Imaging Services eligible for reimbursements provided by a facility are available only if accredited and has demonstrated holding the accreditation annually to the Commission of Health. In January 2013 to December 2013, MDH was exempting dentists using the CBCT from requirements, and dental registrants were notified of this exemption. After the Department of Health review the statutory language internally, though, it was determined they did not have the authority to exempt the dental CBCT technology from requirement, and they retroactively applied the statute to now include dentists. So this determination was made last December after the August 2013 deadline for accreditation. So many CBCT registrants did not pursue accreditation, which was a negative impact because the process is very costly, time-consuming, and has several requirements that must be met prior to application. It was hard on the small dental clinics. So this bill, Madam Chair and members, exempts the dental CBCT users from reporting and accreditation requirements, and it clears up the exemption language in the bill, which was currently expressed in the statutes 144.1225. The current statute lists the CT but does not give clear guidance to the CBCT technician. So the Dental Association's big concerns were that the registrants were assured they were exempt, and that only defined that the Department of Health changed that and reversed that. And their other concern was the requirement for the dental CBCT users were varying greatly from medical CT scanning and the technology. With that, Madam Chair and members, I do have an amendment, the A1 amendment. I'd like to move, please.
The A1 amendment will be distributed.
Should I explain the amendment, why it's being passed
out? Sure. Senator Rosen, please.
Thank you. Madam Chair and members, this actually came from Senator Kiffmeyer, and it was a bill that was introduced the first part of January, and it deals with the accreditation process for advanced diagnostic imaging services requirements, and this actually was a specific constituent of hers. So what the amendment would do is give a new diagnostic facility 6 months to become certified, which would allow the facility to take the necessary images it needs to take to become certified and get paid for the images. Apparently, there are no problems with this bill from the department or other third party. So with that, I'd like to move the A1 amendment.
Senator Rosen moves the A1 amendment. Any questions? All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Motion passes.
And Madam Chair,
Senator
I do
Rosen?
Have several people that would like to speak on this. Dr. Mansoor Ahmad, the Director of Oral Maxillofacial Radiology Department at the University of Minnesota of Dentistry, School of Dentistry.
Madam Chair,
thank
you. Cone beam CT is an X-ray machine used.
Please introduce yourself first for the record.
Mansoor Ahmad, Associate Professor at the University of Minnesota School of Dentistry.
Thank you, and please proceed.
So a cone beam CT is an X-ray machine used in dentistry to generate three-dimensional images of the jaws. The doses from this machine is similar to a full mouth set of radiographs that's generally obtained in a dental office. The dose from this machine is significantly lower than medical CT. The requirement for accreditation puts a significant amount of burden on the dentists. It has a large amount of educational requirement. The education can be provided by a board-certified oral and maxillofacial radiologist, and currently in the state, I'm the only one. So that would be a significant burden for the dentist to come and seek my training for these courses. So concept is good that we should provide minimum radiation to the patient. We are currently doing that already. The machines are low dose. The requirement is onerous, difficult to achieve at this time. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Did you want to have your other testifiers?
Yes, Madam Chair. And I actually was reminded that I need to delete Section 2. I'd like to make an oral amendment to delete Section 2 of the bill, starting on line 2.19. And Madam Chair, I will have Mr. Spazzetto speak to that. But I think it's basically unnecessary, is there?
Did you want him to speak to it before we act on it or see if there's any questions, or did you want to just
I'd like
take
to
care
it.
Of it? Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Rosen moves the oral amendment to delete Section 2. Any questions? All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Mr. Sposito, were you going to address that specifically?
Madam Chairman, yes. Dominic Sposito, I represent the Minnesota Dental Association, and I just wanted to highlight what you just did was actually make make the law a little more understandable and clarifying that we're only exempting the dentist from the certification process that is required. And as the doctor said, it would be very difficult for us to set that up, especially since the law, the interpretation of the law is retroactive to August of last year. So basically, we're already out of compliance with that statute. The reason we got rid of the second section is that went beyond the certification and actually engaged in reporting information, which we don't really need to be exempted from because we will be doing that under the current statute. So that section is no longer necessary. And so it's very clear that we're only exempting the dental cone beam from the certification process, which has not yet been established. At some point in the future, there may be a certification process for these machines. I don't think it will be as extensive as the MRI and the CAT scan certification. But as of today, there is nothing like that, so it's virtually impossible for us to comply. So this basically clarifies the law as it was meant, we believe, to apply to the larger machines. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Are there any questions for either of the testifiers? Senator Rosen?
Madam Chair, then I would move that Senate file 2510 be recommended to pass and moved into the Omnibus Health
as
and
amended?
Human Services Policy Bill.
As amended?
As amended. Thank you.
And did she say to lay over?
Yeah.
Okay, she said. Senator Rosen moves. And is there any other discussion or questions? All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Motion passes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, before we move on,
can
we pick up Metzen's bill again? I have gotten confirmation from DHS that I've gotten all my answers, and there is no cost. I don't think we even need to call anybody up. If I move, we pick up 2284 from the table.
So moved.
And then I move that Senate file 2284, did we amend it? As amended, be recommended to pass and laid over for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Health and Human Services Policy Bill.
I think he did that.
Okay.
Yeah. You don't think you can?
Is that a proper motion?
It's proper. I understand it's proper. Is there any further discussion on Senate File 2284? Hearing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Thank you.
Okay, now we're going to do items 13-7 for Senate 38.
Next, we will take up Senate File 1738. Senator Hayden. Minnesota Family Investment Program and General Assistance Random Drug Testing Requirements Modification.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair. How are
Senator
you?
Hayden. Good.
Good. I have Senate File 1738. Or I'd like to move Senate File 1738, I guess is what you want me to do. I don't know if you want me to put my amendment on first, or do you want to go through the bill? Why don't I put the A1 amendment just to get the bill in the shape that I need it to be in?
Senator Hayden moves the A1 amendment, which will be distributed. Senator Hayden moves the A1 amendment. It's an author's amendment. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. In the interest of brevity, I'll just give you a brief outline of what the bill does and then turn it over to Commissioner Tony Carter of Ramsey County. Senate File 1738 repeals mandatory testing and restores county discretion to drug tests. as was the law prior to the change in 2012. We feel that mandatory testing is an unfunded mandate on counties, and it is both administratively burdensome and costly. DHS reports this population of MFIB and GA has a lower rate of drug use than the general population in Minnesota. And with that, Madam Chair, I'll turn it over to Commissioner Tony Carter, who is a commissioner in Ramsey County and the chair of AMC.
Thank you. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Tony Carter. I'm a Ramsey County Commissioner, and I'm the current chair of the Association of Minnesota Counties, and I'll be speaking on behalf of both those organizations today. Senate File 1738 addresses a 2012 change for MFIP that recently became effective. Current law requires that MFIP, GA, and MSA applicants who've been convicted of a drug offense are subject to random drug tests. Positive drug tests result in sanctions and, in some cases, ineligibility for an individual, and, of course, for MFIP recipients, that affects an entire family unit. Under current law, counties are delegated the responsibility for implementing and enforcing this policy. However, the state did not provide any additional funds for this program or service. So in order to pay for it, counties must either take funding away from other programs or services or increase the property tax. Additionally, this law forces counties to use valuable staff time and resources for a program that most counties do not feel is valuable for clients, do not feel is valuable to our taxpayers or to the overall integrity of our programs for the purpose of serving these clients. SF 1738 would provide counties the flexibility to make the initiative meaningful. Mandating drug testing for all recipients is punitive, inexpensive, and in most cases, unproductive. So giving the counties discretion to use this as one of many tools in working with our counties or working with our clients is an approach that regards the work of counties as important, informed, and valuable, and also regards and recognizes MFIP, GA, and MSA enrollees as residents who need basic support services to achieve the best outcomes in their lives, and not as drug addicts or criminals. Let's look at the cost of the program and the number of people who are to be involved. And to illustrate this, I thought I'd bring you Ramsey County numbers. They are unique to Ramsey County, but they do illustrate the reality of this mandated drug testing. So in September of 2013, our county received a list from DHS of 517 convicted drug felons who were currently on economic assistance programs in Ramsey County. This list included all felony drug convictions dating back for the diversionary work program 10 years and MFIP 10 years and dating back to 1997 for individuals who are on GA and MSA. These 517 names were then matched with the economic assistance program they are currently receiving. By January of 2014, the 517 names on the DH list had dwindled to only 279, or 54% of that list, still enrolled. So this reflects the typical churn of these programs as people move on and off of assistance. Note that the 517 is just a fraction of the total enrollees in these programs in Ramsey County. To give you a snapshot of current enrollment numbers, in general assistance, Ramsey County has 3,328 enrollees. The number with a drug conviction, 56. For MSA, 5,416 enrollees. Of that, 181 with a drug conviction. On MFIP and DWP, 7,535 enrollees, of which 42 have a drug conviction. And then the balance was the 238 that are not currently enrolled. I just want to point out, too, that in Minnesota, our drug laws provide that we don't know what the nature of the drug crimes that these felonies were convicted of were. It's interesting that the only drug crime in Minnesota that is a misdemeanor is possession of less than 42.5 grams of marijuana, possession, which has a fine of $200. This treatment of marijuana possession is fairly common in many states, but laws vary from state to state, and in some states, possession without intent to distribute the drug tend to be charged as misdemeanors. Not so in Minnesota. I would also like to share with you a little bit of data about those people who are enrolled in our programs. Of course, as you know, of the 42 who qualify for this drug testing that are on MFIP, those MFIP or DWP, for the MFIP clients, those entire families, including children with sanction, would be affected. For GA and MSA, the numbers look like this. Of the 56 clients on general assistance who would qualify for testing, 13% are 55 and older. And on MSA, of the 181, 62 are 55 and older, or 34%. I would also remind you that in these programs, we do have our elderly and disabled who are very much at risk and much in need of support. So in Ramsey County, the projected cost in staff for sending out notices, conducting the actual tests, recording the results, and following up with notices of penalties and the like is $51,337 for the first 52 cases being tested. That amounts to $1,000 roughly per case. Counties who are responsible for the delivery and management of MFIP, GA, and MSA programs overall don't believe that the current drug testing mandate is effective, that it is fiscally responsible, or that it is productive in helping individuals who may have chemical dependency problems or have been engaged in criminal activities involving drugs. In fact, the law may be unconstitutional. It certainly compounds discrimination against some of the most financially vulnerable populations. If we need to test welfare recipients for drugs in an effort to protect the integrity of our taxpayer dollars, then why aren't we testing students who receive educational grants and loans, or small business owners receiving state subsidies, or veterans receiving state aid, or the elderly, blind, and disabled for that matter, some of which, as I already said, are part of this population. The current policy is based on the false perception that large numbers of welfare recipients are using illegal drugs. However, a recent Department of Human Services analysis found that those enrolled in Minnesota's cash assistance programs for low-income individuals and families are actually far less likely to have a felony drug conviction than our entire adult population as a whole. So in summary, the policy to randomly drug test and vendor pay shelter and utilities for persons convicted of felony drug offenses has resulted in increased cost and administrative challenges at the county level. Counties have been delegated the responsibility without additional resources to handle it. Counties are incurring costs associated with the identification, notification, and administration of these tests for very, very small amounts of recipients who are subject to the law. In Chisago County, officials recently cross-checked a list of welfare recipients and found just one person subject to the rule. The county had spent already $1,500 in staff time developing the proper protocol to test this one individual. Again, counties weren't given any additional support to carry it out. We are also learning that some people are losing benefits, not as a result of failing a drug test, but due to failure to comply with new paperwork requirements associated with this new law. A particular challenge is providing notice of this requirement to recipients who may be homeless or transitory. AMC supports the flexibility that is proposed in Senate File 1738 Changing the policy from mandatory to permissive will allow counties to exercise discretion and to determine whether and when it is appropriate within their counties. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Did you have any other testifiers?
No, Madam Chair.
Are there questions? Committee members have questions.
Madam Chair.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Commissioner Carter, I'm just looking at the language in Senator Hayden, and it's on 1.16. It says basically shall lose eligibility for benefits. We're striking the language for any positive test results by an illegal controlled substance or discharge of sentence after conviction for another drug felony. Commissioner Carter, is there any reason that you believe that someone should lose their eligibility?
Ms. Carter.
That I would believe they should.
Is there any reason why they should not be receiving services? Anything? I mean, I would think another conviction for a drug felony, number two, is pretty severe. And I'm having a hard time wrapping my head around this. It seems like we just took it right back to the basic level, and we were trying to get our hands on. I understand the cost to the counties. I understand that. But you also said there was protocols that were put in place by counties to deal with this, which I think is very important, and they should have had protocols in place. So if anything, this has made the counties get organized and put together some kind of, sheet that says this is what we need to do, some boundaries. But I look at this bill and I think we're just going backwards, because now there is no boundaries at all for these benefits. And I'm having problems. So I'm asking you, is there any reason why anybody should lose their benefits at all?
I did not prepare to testify as to why people should lose their benefits. I would share with you that the programs that we're talking about, general assistance, supplemental assistance, MFIP, DWP, are programs that we put in place in Minnesota because we believe that people should have assistance to be able to take care of basic needs, and that people with families should be able to care for children. I can tell you that as I look at and as counties have regarded this current legislation and the fact that it requires the mandatory drug testing, shows us that we are going to have to experience an inordinate expense for results that seem not to fit the expenses that are being now as unfunded mandates placed upon counties. We seem not to be getting the result that we need.
So Madam Chair, I think that Commissioner Carter has been very eloquent in kind of giving you a sense of what is going on in the practical day-to-day of the counties. I'd also like to have Jessica Webster talk a little bit about the language and what it's striking, and Senator Rosen, what then we go back to. And I think that that might be helpful for your question.
Ms. Webster, please introduce yourself for the record.
Madam Chair, Senator Rosen, my name is Jessica Webster. I'm a staff attorney with Legal Aid. And my interpretation of this language, and I think it could be finessed or changed if that's the will of the body, but the language that's stricken is and shall lose eligibility for benefits for 5 years beginning the month following, and it strikes, obviously, one and two. But if you look at the full sentence before that stricken language, it says, persons subject to the limitations of this subdivision who become eligible for assistance under this chapter may be subject to random drug testing as a condition of continued eligibility. So to me, that still is within the spirit of restoring discretion to the county on whether or not to continue eligibility for a person who tests positive or who has a subsequent conviction. And I would think that if a caseworker sees someone who is kind of showing some of the hallmarks of needing treatment, needing further assistance, and they wanted to exercise the discretion to test, this still gives the county that discretion. But what it does do is it strikes a mandate, a state mandate, on what the county must do.
Madam Chair. Senator Rosen, does that?
Yeah, that helps, Madam Chair, but I'm still struggling a little bit with. Okay, so then let me just take it a different direction, Commissioner Carter. And I certainly understand the unfunded mandate issue with counties. I mean, that is severe. So you've had, since 2012, so you've had basically a whole year to look at your budget of mandatory versus what you've done in the past. Do you have any figures as far as what it used to be and how much more dollars it is that you have to do it mandatory? Or, I mean, are the guidelines set that if you feel that somebody does, I'm trying to figure out, I mean, what would prompt you to do a volunteer, or just a drug testing on somebody prior to 2012? What would prompt you to do that?
Commissioner Carter.
I understand your question. In the past, we have been able to utilize the discretion to do drug testing, where within the course of the management of a case, a social worker might suspect the need to do so. So in the past, that's been in the course of that case management, whereas now there is a special administration and program that is set up which requires its own identification process, calling through the list, determining who is eligible, and it is the administration that we have to focus on and actually provide for in terms of the finance required. So we know now that that cost us an additional $1,000 per person for whom, just for these first 52, that is going to be required. In the past, we would be looking at that as a part of the relationship, as a part of the case management. I don't have a figure to share with you because it is in the natural course of working with an individual that that would have happened. There will be specific numbers for the drug test itself. I don't have those numbers. Perhaps someone else here would today.
There is a provision, Madam Chair and Senator Rosen, that just says that the data from the Department of Human Service, low-income participants in these programs have far lower rate of use than the general population. Drug testing can range from $15 to $150 plus the administrative cost. So I think that what I also trying to just illustrate is that this didn't get to its intended purpose. It didn't create, there weren't an unfettered amount of people who were using drugs, or there wasn't a direct corollary between someone's past criminal history of using and them being on the program and then continuing. I think that that's what we're trying to say, and get the law back in a way in which it allows the counties, as Commissioner Carter said, in the relationship to have the opportunity to, if they detect that someone is using drugs, or they see that, they have the ability to start to do the testing and go down a road of recovery, or others, if that's what they want to do. They still have that ability. We're saying that this law in particular sets up this mandatory process using, you know, what some thought when we did the bill that, oh, if they got caught using drugs and by the police at some point, that there's a correlation to they must still be using, because that's what we're doing, is we're cross-referencing the Department of Public Safety database with the Department of Human Service database to come up with a list of people who we might suspect, and then we're going down telling the counties that they have to go through this process, not based on their assessment of a person, but based on what their prior usage was. And that's, or not even their prior usage if they got caught, because that's what the DPS database is going to do. So that may not satisfy you. I just want you to just try to articulate what we're trying to do here.
Thank you.
Senator Benson first, and then Senator Eaton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Hayden, you had mentioned participants in MFIP are lower than average in their drug use, and that's fine, but we're targeting a specific population, people who've already shown a propensity to use drugs because they've been convicted of drug use. And so I'd like to take the general population argument off. We're not asking to test the general population. I've heard that a couple of times, and it will lead to inaccuracies leaving this committee. We're talking about people who've already shown a propensity to use drugs. I'm a little concerned that we are now moving to county by county use of judgment and problems we could have with disparate impact, and then end up in court. And so since I don't understand the history of drug testing by county, perhaps you could enlighten us. Do counties have uniform protocols? Is it caseworker by caseworker? Are there best practices for counties that have kept us out of court in the past? Because if we're going to move to a May provision and there's one caseworker who has a spike in people she chooses to, or he chooses to, put forward for drug testing, now we have a court issue. Whereas if it is shall and counties can't leave it to the discretion of an individual, we have some more boundaries. So help me out here.
So, Madam Chair,
Senator Hayden, and
before Commissioner Carter answers, and I don't know if I look at Ms. Webster, you know, this provision had been in law before, so I don't know if we have information from DHS or others to say if we were caught in litigation in the years leading up to 2012, because that's what we're going back to. So I appreciate you having the question of was that the right role? But I think we should have that, and I wasn't prepared to. That's a great question, but I don't know if Ms. Webster or others from the department can talk about what happened up to 2012 and if there was a problem with the way the counties administered at that point.
Ms. Webster?
Madam Chair and Senator Benson, this law was in effect. This law came into effect after AFDC turned into the TANF program, and there was no litigation that I'm aware of and no problems with patchwork policies of testing that I'm aware of.
And Madam Chair,
Senator Benson,
was there any testing? And if so, what were the results of that testing? Who can tell me that? If the law was in effect for 12 years, which counties were testing? How many people did they test? And what were the results?
So, Madam Chair, Senator Benson, I don't know if we have someone from the department that might be here to help get you the information that you're looking for.
Welcome. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Larry Hosh. I'm with the Department of Human Services. Prior to the recent legislation, this has been in place since 1997, which if somebody disclosed that they were a convicted drug felon, that they would be subject to random testing. We have internal case reviews in the department, and I can give you one instance. One of our case reviews in St. Louis County showed a person who was a self-identified convicted drug felon. We brought that up in that audit of the case review. St. Louis County implemented a policy, and actually two different policies, because they contracted with a third party, two different third parties, and they had testing. We hadn't tracked the occurrence of testing in our system, but in the last year we have reprogrammed MAXIS in which we can track how many tests have been given, the results, and any case notes associated with those tests.
Senator Benson, does that answer your question?
Chair, and is it Representative Hosh, or what's your appropriate title? Mr. Hosh. So we have no track record of what the testing was prior to this law being put in place.
Mr. Hosh.
Madam Chair, Senator Benson, we do have some track record from those internal case reviews and the audits, but just recently did we implement the programming that we needed to track the testing and that within MAXIS. So it's only recent data that we have in which we could provide you.
Okay. And Madam Chair,
Benson,
just to wrap up, so we're really in the most expensive part of implementing this. We're reprogramming MAXIS, which is happening for a lot of other reasons. There are administrative costs that are always higher at the front end. So we've been in this program less than a year, and we're in the most expensive part of any program, which is implementation. And so I think perhaps the 52,000 number, while accurate, is an inflated number if we're going to attempt to use it going forward, because the learning curve has now happened, the programming has happened, training has happened. So I think we're going to see costs on this drop precipitously as we go forward.
Senator Eaton, did you have a question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have more of a comment, I think. Having spent a lot of my professional life working in addiction, I just wanted to comment about the actual process and use of drug testing as a punitive thing. It is relapse as a part of the disease of addiction, and to say that someone who has a relapse should be punished is pretty contrary to how we deal with most diseases. If someone has diabetes and they have a high blood sugar, we don't fine them. It's a lot of these people are in who end up getting caught. I know a couple. They're in programs for their drug use, and by this program, they lose the funding to be in that program. So it defeats the whole purpose of the program. It's the best way to use drug testing is as a tool to encourage someone for sobriety, not to do a gotcha.
Thank you. Senator Nino.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Benson, as is often the case, stole a lot of my questions. But as someone who's authored legislation on this topic in the past, I can tell you a lot of the questions and concerns that came from the counties and the county representatives were about lawsuits. They were concerned that if we enacted legislation, that if they had discretion, that they were going to get sued. That was absolutely the concerns that they conveyed to me as someone who was promoting legislation to make a little bit more robust. My legislation was attempting to target those who were demonstrating symptoms. And it wasn't about gotcha. Everybody gets into this conversation of, oh, we're punishing, you know, people that are down on their luck or the underprivileged or whatever. It's not about gotcha. It's about the fact that usually we've got kids involved. And when this money is being used to buy meth and heroin or whatever, almost always that means it's not getting down to the kids that it's intended to help. And if we go to a voluntary reporting system where someone has to come up and say, hello, I'm a felon, I had a drug crime last week, we're not going to target those. I mean, we're not going to catch those. I don't know that what we had in law before was perfect, but I do kind of get the sense that this is going in the wrong direction. I think we're going to have fewer testing. And I never argued when I promoted the legislation. You know, the question of cost came up, and I said, you know what, it probably won't be on a balance sheet. It probably won't be cost effective. It probably won't save the state money. But that's not the goal. The goal is to try to find people that have a problem, particularly when there's kids involved, and try to help fix it. And I think with this approach, we're going the other direction, and we're going to find fewer of them.
Senator Hayden.
So good. Well, thank you, Senator Nenow. And I would hope that as we move forward, these we all have experienced these issues in our lives, families, or we hear from our constituents, and we all have approaches that we think are, you know, going to be the most effective way. And so I do want to just say to the committee members or whatever, this is not an indictment on one's personal view is right or wrong, or that what we're doing is you know, is somehow nefarious, or that you wanting to do this or not support this would be that. I have a personal view on the issue as well, being a child of an alcoholic and has a father who has a treatment center that you guys have talked about a lot, and my wife is in this business as well and spends a lot of time in your county at the Hazleton Betty Ford Foundation. And so I think that this unnecessarily kind of not only puts an administrative burden on counties, but also kind of puts a stigma on those who have gotten themselves in trouble before but are now trying to move forward. That's just my view. It doesn't mean that if you feel differently that you're not, that you don't have an opinion. In addition, I think that we should look at this at a broader level and just say, just because you got caught, or just because you got caught and didn't get convicted, doesn't mean that we should have a really strong look at people and families that are coming in that are suffering from drug abuse. And that I think that this is what Commissioner Carter and the county folks are saying, is that they're really working on looking at those issues. We're doing a lot of reform on this level in DHS. We're reforming MFIB so that it can be something that actually helps people move from where they are to so that they can be productive. And if there are barriers in the way like chemical dependency, then we really want to figure out what to do. The law enforcement side of this will eventually catch up with people if they're doing things that they shouldn't do, like, you know, diverting their money to drugs or doing things that they shouldn't. We have great analytics in the department and in each county. They do a great job in figuring that out. I just personally felt like this was not the way that we should go, and that's kind of what I brought forward. But I do want to know that as sensitive as this is, I don't want members to walk away if you support it or not feeling as though we're indicting you because you don't feel the same way that I or people promoting this bill would do. I just want to make sure that we you know that's how I feel. So.
Commissioner Carter, did
just
you?
From the perspective of the counties, we do realize that everyone wants to ensure that we are paying our utmost attention to making certain that the dollars that are provided go to their intended purposes. where children are concerned. You know, I have as great a heart as all of you would to make certain that is the case. First of all, it still remains an unfunded mandate for counties. And secondly, I know that you want all of our attention on all of the recipients and those for whom they care to make certain that whether a person has been convicted in the past or not, we're having that one-on-one focus and attention to ensure that counties are still doing our very best job to provide the wraparound service that is needed to ensure those best outcomes. So we want to do this. We want to have the discretion to do this. We would like to be able to in each and every case, and that's where we want the attention placed. We think that when we have the discretion, we do the better job of identifying whether convicted before or newly, perhaps using drugs. I want to thank you for your attention.
Thank you. Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, just a comment and then a question. I'm not sure that it's exactly related here, but, you know, I know that there's probably many Minnesotans that are a bit troubled by the revelations. I think it was in Saturday's paper about the couple who was collecting $167,000 of Minnesota welfare, and yet they were living on a $1 million yacht. They were double collecting in Minnesota and in Florida, and living on Lake Minnetonka at the same time. So I think it's understandable why Minnesotans are concerned that we don't have very good ways of really monitoring and making sure that our dollars are really helping those most in need. And so I just say that. I don't think it was your county. I believe it was Hennepin County, and maybe at some point there's someone from Hennepin County who can talk to us about how do we know something like this isn't going to happen again, and what things are they putting in place to better make sure that we're actually using a safety net to help those in need and not people who are defrauding the system. But to my question is, do you know the in Florida, did not Florida, I'm just kind of wondering about what the results are in other states that did this. I think in Florida, if I'm not mistaken, they required drug testing for welfare recipients. But then I remember reading an article after they had instituted that, that actually they decided not to do that because they found out it was costing so much more and they weren't actually getting any benefit from that. And I'm just wondering if somebody can comment on that. I just think I recall reading that at some point.
Yeah, well, Senator, thank you, Senator Nelson and Madam Chair. Just on your first question, I think that you're right that we are always looking to try to make sure that the benefits that are getting are to the person that is most needed. I do know that we know that in just high-profile national cases that sophisticated people sometimes put together sophisticated schemes that are hard for us to catch. And so we saw that the last couple of years with Bernie Madoff and Tom Petters and all these folks. So I would hope that that is the anomaly. And I think that the counties at some point, if we have a hearing, will talk about their analytics and the way they go about tracking those things. But, you know, we all know that often people who are very sophisticated and have their mind on doing something nefarious can find ways around the system. And I'm glad they caught them and would be more than and I'd be more than interested to understand how these folks, clearly very, very smart people, decided that they needed our MA money in order to make their yachts work or whatever. So I agree with you. And I don't know if we want to talk to anybody about the Florida situation, but anecdotally, I read the same thing, that it was below the average and it cost more to administer the program than the savings that they got for people who they caught. That's just what I know. If we want more detail, I know that there may be Ms. West or Mr. Hosh or someone may know a little more about that, but I read the same thing.
I read that as well.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For somebody who truly does believe in second chances and the ability, you know, giving a helping hand to people, I don't believe that this bill, just going back to the language prior to 2012, is exactly the way to go. I think there's a lot of left unwork and coordination that needs to be done, and some comfort level that needs to be applied in this this move, because obviously we are going to have people that are going to abuse it, and I think there should be some boundaries. And actually, I do think the exercise was good for the counties to go through this to figure out exactly their protocols and, you know, how they are going about this. So even though I am going to be voting no on this, I wanted to state that I think second chances are very important, but this is still not just going back to prior language is not always the best way of doing it.
Well, Madam Senator Chair, Hayden. Senator Rosen, thank you. I don't necessarily disagree that maybe there is a third way that makes people more comfortable. I think today this is the way that I'd like to pursue it. And one of the issues is that as long as I've been in this legislature, I know that we all have relationships with our county folks and our constituents and others. And so I know that often sometimes people will tell me things that they have seen, and then that's some, and I then kind of get going on that a little bit, and then I start pushing legislation to do that. One of the things that I hadn't heard, and I kind of remember when this happened, though it kind of got enacted late, so we're kind of getting back to it, I think, a year later than I would have wanted to, is I hadn't heard people, other than the anecdotal evidence, that these folks are, that these folks who had prior drug convictions are getting money and then using them on drugs. I think that there's some intuitive notion that we kind of think about, if a person had this issue before, then they get this, then that's what they're doing. But I hadn't heard or saw the evidence. Not to say that there isn't. I just don't remember that being presented, but it has been a while before this bill got presented, so I don't want to get the committee riled up to get me to remember that. I just hadn't heard that through the discussion, that this was something that was a problem that we needed to fix, though I think that intuitively it's easy to kind of follow that progression. So, Senator Rose, I know we work together on a lot of these issues, especially chemical dependency, so I look forward, if there is a way that helps, that is not so administrative and is getting the outcomes that we're looking for, I'd be more than willing to, you know, as we move forward to work on that with you.
Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Hayden, I too am going to be voting no today, but I think there are, I do hope that you continue to work on this, and particularly I think it'd be so helpful if we could help before the next it seems like we have an audience here that we should be encouraging some sort of a treatment option and getting involved in I don't know whether it'd be alcohol or I guess it wouldn't be Alcoholics Anonymous, but it could be Narcotics Anonymous, NA. But it just seems to me that we're doing people a great disservice when there's an issue and yet we're not helping get them to the right resources. And so it seems to me that there's room here to maybe have testing, but then rather than denying benefits, say, you must do this, you must go to some treatment, or we must... I think it's not a humane thing to do to not offer those kind of treatments and encouragements to folks who are facing some sort of an addiction issue.
I appreciate that, Senator.
Senator Hayden.
And Madam Chair, I think what we should do is, and I fault us for this short, fast session, but I think that there is an opportunity for us to visit with some of the folks in the department and the county. And I don't know if we've been able to articulate all the things that they can do and all the things that they do that may give you more relief in that matter before we put it in statute. But I think that Commissioner Carter and people from the department and myself are more than willing to have that conversation so that if we do make a change, we can do that. I think that the system prior to 2012 was working well, and I think that the best interest of the client to do humane things were there. But I think we need to have a more robust conversation to make sure that
go ahead, Senator Hayden.
Well, I don't want to cut off the discussion, but if there isn't any more, I'd like to move Senate File 1738.
1738 as amended to be passed and recommended to be referred to finance. Any other discussion? All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
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 Any opposed?
No.
No. Motion passes.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Now we'll move to Senator Hoffman, Senate File 1840, Family Child Care Caregiver Requirements Modifications.
Madam Chair and members.
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you. There's an A1 amendment that you should have in front of you.
Yeah, we have it.
I would like to move the A1 amendment.
And do we have it?
Yeah, it's in here.
Senator Hoffman moves the A1 amendment. This is your first... So it's an author's amendment. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Motion passes.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Thank you for the opportunity to talk about Senate File 1840 today. With me at the table is Lisa Thompson, who is a licensed family child care provider here in St. Paul. Senate File 1840 is a simple bill. When we talk about unsession, this is about as unsession as it gets. It fits nicely into this unsession theme that the governor has set this year. And basically, I'll be clear, it simplifies the age categories for family child care to give greater flexibility to providers to care for the children in their home. I can certainly go into more detail, but the committee would be better served to hear from an actual provider. With that, Madam Chair, I'd like to turn this over to Lisa Thompson, a family child care provider here in St. Paul.
Welcome. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Madam Chair, my name is Lisa Thompson. And good afternoon.
Thank you.
As Senator Hoffman said, I'm a family child care provider here in St. Paul. And my testimony is on behalf of members and supporters of family child care providers. It's a very simple bill defining when a child will be categorized as a preschooler, a school ager, a child in a family child care setting. It simplifies and streamlines the age categories. With this bill, a child is an infant until their first birthday, a toddler until their second birthday, a preschooler until their fifth birthday, and a school-ager until their 11th birthday, at which point they age out of being counted in the ratios for family child care home. Currently, a child continues to be counted as a preschooler until 4 months prior to the first day a child is eligible to attend kindergarten in the fall. While that definition is understandable for school-based programs that operate on a school-based calendar or center-based programs that separate children into school-age exclusive groups, this age cutoff isn't reflective of family child care environment. Family child care operates like a family, and as I'm sure I don't need to tell any of you, siblings are rarely born according to the school calendar. And children are together in one small group, regardless of their age. The accreditation and the rating tools assess how well a provider blends the various ages according to children's individual needs, not according to the child's eligibility for public school enrollment. Now, other states, a couple of examples, Kansas, North Dakota, the military, follow this straightforward model for family child care ratios. And I hope you will support the simplification, and I'm happy to answer questions.
Thank you. Members, do you have any questions for the testifier? Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have the A2 amendment. Is this an appropriate time for that?
If there's not, I guess, other discussion, yeah, we can.
Madam Chair, let me think about that first. I'm kidding.
Okay. The A2 amendment will be distributed.
Would you like me to describe it,
sure.
Madam Chair?
Sure. Can you describe it, please?
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. This is just adding on to the good work that Senator Hoffman has done. And basically, it was. I'll tell you what the intent of this amendment is as it's coming out. It looks a lot longer than it is. But basically, it was to take care of three issues regarding child care. And let me say right from the outset that this amendment has been worked with the department. They're here to testify in favor of this amendment. It's been worked with the child care providers. Basically, the child care providers in my district brought this concern to me, three concerns. One had to do with safe sleep. And basically what happened in Olmsted County, believe it or not, was that a provider was issued a correction because
She had enough safe sleep areas for every child who was there, but the child who was sick, that safe sleep area had the clean sheets folded and laying on top of the mattress instead of actually put over the mattress, because obviously the child wasn't there that day. So this is just a correction in what we mean by how many infants need to have safe sleep areas, and that would be the number of infants that are there. Makes a lot of sense to us, but I guess we have to put it in statute. The second item, and that's on section 3, page 2.8, just has to do with contractors who are serving multiple family child care license holders in a county. Currently, they have to be go through approval for each individual licensed home child care place that they would go through. So a lot of redundancy there, and this is just saying, you know, once you've gone through all the checks for the county, if you're okay for one licensed family care, you should also be that same background check and such would be okay for all the family child care providers in the county. And then the third item had to do with just some streamlining in training regarding so that the SIDS death reduction training and the abusive head trauma training could be provided both at the same time in a single course. So basically, I think these are what some would consider kind of some unsession language. In other words, making our government more effective, more efficient, and doing a little bit of streamlining. To my knowledge, there's absolutely no opposition to this amendment. And as I said, there are people in the audience who are more than willing to testify in favor of this, if that would be the chair or Senator Hoffman's concern.
Madam Chair,
Senator
Hoffman. I accept the friendly amendment, and we'll move this on.
Thank you. And if I could,
Senator Lori,
accept that amendment, can we absolutely determine, number one, that there's no cost to this, and number two, that there's not nipples in here? That was
Senator Lori.
All right. No, can we get the department to confirm that there is absolutely no cost to this? Because if you're...
Yes.
And then also, has this been run by the Judiciary Committee regarding the background study issues brought up in here? I mean, this could take a very simple bill, add additional stops. I don't know. It's the first time I've seen...
Senator Nelson.
It's a good question on the Judiciary Committee. I cannot answer that for you. We do have the Department of Health here who can certainly answer the fiscal note, which I know is clearly important. And I'd be glad to help work this through the Judiciary Committee if there's any issues.
Please introduce yourself for the record.
Yes, Madam Chair, members, Reggie Wagner with the Department of Human Services. No, this does not have a fiscal note. It kind of streamlines, as Senator Nelson has said, some of the existing procedures, just makes clear what we think the practice already is with regards to the role of the county licensing. Might actually make it a little bit clearer by having some of that language in Section 1, which would then reduce any administrative costs for people having to, you know, seek an appeal or a reconsideration of a violation that they don't believe a correction order that should have been issued. Streamlines the existing requirement for both the SUID and the abusive head trauma. So we view these as sort of more technical and administrative.
Thank you. Senator Lori, any other questions, or does that answer your question?
And then I don't know what you want to do about the question regarding judiciary.
Well, counsel has advised me that Section 6 most likely would need to go, or would need to go, to judiciary.
Madam Chair, Senator Lori, I was just informed that it does have to go to judiciary, and that's got to meet that second deadline, which could be problematic. You raise a great point, Senator Lori, and especially when we're putting stuff in here. Is a prime example of good intentional work is being held up by a process, and I don't know if we can get into judiciary in a week. This should be fairly simple.
Senator Hoffman, I don't know if we can. Senator Benson?
And Madam Chair, if the problem is just with the contractors piece. Perhaps Senator Nelson would like to amend her amendment to take out the contractors piece so the rest can move forward. If I don't want Senator Hoffman to reject the good pieces of this simply because he's concerned about his bill getting snagged.
Senator Nelson?
I do. I think that's one option. I will say it has gone through the House. Did it go through the House civil law already? No.
Chair, go ahead.
Madam Chair, Senator Nelson, this was only heard in the early childhood and youth policy and referred to, I believe, Health and Human Services Finance. At that time, I don't believe anybody had acknowledged that it needed to go to civil law.
Madam Chair.
Senator Nelson.
So what I'd like to do, if it's possible, I'd like to keep the entire amendment intact. However, if we don't get into judiciary or meeting with the judiciary chair, if there's some more clear language, I would be more than happy to delete this section on the Senate floor if, in fact, we don't get clarity on this. I get a sense that we will get clarity on this if it gets rolled. Can we do that? I guess my question would be,
Madam
can
Chair,
we do
Senator
that?
I don't know how this would get to the Senate floor if judiciary wants to see it. And so I am going to suggest that if these provisions are good, we lay it on the table and get clarity with judiciary, and then we could quickly as a committee move this bill at a later point in time. Otherwise, I'm afraid this dies between here and judiciary.
Madam Chair.
Okay. Senator Nelson.
So this is probably one of the most streamlined aspects that's really going to help, I think, taxpayers, child care providers, and their contractors. So the other two pieces are important as well. Might I be able to check with judiciary and see if we can get this on the agenda for judiciary before deadline, and then follow up with Senator Hoffman? Would you be willing, Senator Hoffman, to let me see what I can do as far as getting this piece heard? Actually, I'm going to need some help from counsel because I'm not exactly sure how to get an amendment heard in judiciary unless it's been attached to a bill that's moving.
Madam Chair and members, this is a good conversation, and I would like to hear from counsel because then I think my direction is going to be probably sections 3 and section 6 to pull them out as I'm hearing the consensus of this group, and then perhaps have the conversation with judiciary. We can always, if this thing ends up going to the floor, we can always add this on as an amendment somehow.
Sure.
Smiling, shaking heads. So I think I would take the path of least resistance. And I don't know, I don't want to spend 8 hours in front of judiciary, do you?
That's supposed to be funny.
I mean, Madam Chair, so if we could hear from counsel on the concerns that this group is hearing, I'd be more than happy to entertain that.
Senator Nelson, what do you think about that? So the request is to amend your amendment by removing Section 3 and Section 6. Is that correct?
And Madam Chair, Senator Nelson, there are two
Senator
provisions
Hoffman.
In there that we just can exfoliate and then move on. Okay.
Is that what she's at? That's what he's asking. I don't know.
Well, for the moment, does counsel have any comment on this?
Madam Chair and Senator, if Sections 3 and 6 stay in the bill and are amended into the bill, it will need to go to judiciary. If they're taken out, it doesn't have a fiscal impact, and it was a possible inclusion in the omnibus bill, I assume. The other option is to see if there is an existing bill in a judiciary that you could amend these two sections onto, not this bill but a different one. That's another option.
Thank you, Madam
Senator
Chair.
Nelson.
So with that in mind, I will delete. I accept Senator Hoffman's delete amendment to my amendment, which deletes Section 3 and 6 so that we can keep it out of judiciary, although I think it's a good place for it to go, and I think this is important language, and I do want to get it in front of the Judiciary
committee, at least for some clarification, and we'll just have to figure out a better way to do that. But for the meantime, I certainly support Senator Hoffman's amendment to my amendment.
Okay. Any further discussion on the oral amendment to the amendment before us? All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? And now to the amendment itself, the A2 amendment. Is there any further discussion about the A2 amendment? Seeing and hearing none, all those in favor of the A2 amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? And now back to your bill, Senator Hoffman.
Move Senate File 1840 be laid over for possible inclusion into the omnibus bill.
As amended.
As amended, and thank you.
Welcome. Any further discussion? All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Motion passes.
Madam Chair and members, thank you for the. It was a very useful amount of our time. I appreciate the input. Thank you.
Thank you. And now we'll move to Senate File 2637. Senator Hayden. This is adult dental services prior medical assistance authorization requirement prohibition.
Chair and
Senator
members,
Hayden.
I have Senate File 2637. The bill before you today deals with four dental benefits were added back into the adult benefit set last session to help the elderly and disabled population receive proper oral health treatment. Administrative issues are making these benefits nearly impossible for the providers to utilize. All of the benefits we passed were covered without prioritization before the legislature cut the adult benefit set in half in 2009. I have Kevin Goodnow representing Appletree Dental here to explain the bill. We also have an amendment that has been worked out with the HMOs to get this bill in its correct order.
Do we have the amendment? We will distribute the amendment. Okay. Senator Hayden moves the A1 amendment. This is your first committee. It's an author's amendment. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed?
Madam Chair, members of the committee,
Mr.
Kevin Goodnow, here on behalf of Appletree Dental. We're here in support of the bill, and what happened was there were four adult benefits under dental benefits that were reinstated last year that were targeted at providing services to people with severe disabilities. They included sedation, house calls, behavioral management, and also more cleanings, cleanings as needed. These were services that were provided prior to 2009. They were eliminated because of some budget issues in 2009. We were able to successfully finally reinstate those because they're needed for these individuals to provide humane and needed health care services for them. One of the problems we're running into, though, now that they've been reinstated is that many of the health plans, well, all the health plans are imposing a certain level of prior authorization before these services can be accessed. The criteria and the way these are being applied will vary from health plan to health plan, and we see some really kind of odd ways that they're being applied. For example, with behavioral management, this is an issue where you can be reimbursed for additional time taken if somebody has a behavioral issue when you're providing the service. Some of the plans are asking for prior authorization on that. The challenge with that is you don't know if there's going to be a behavioral issue until you're serving the person. So it's really impractical in that sort. So those are some examples of what we're dealing with. And what the legislation will do is just say for three of those four dental benefits, the sedation, the house call, and the behavioral issues, that they cannot be prior authorized under this law or under the PMAP programs. We think the way it's being applied right now, it allows for disparate access to coverage, which is a problem for people with severe disabilities. We also think in some cases it's resulting in a denial of access to services or will eventually because providers will stop providing these services. And it's an example of why people, especially the severely disabled, have always been hesitant about going into managed care plans. is because they're worried about how they'll be treated by the various health plans when they when they're dealing with folks that they're not used to dealing with. And so with that, I'd stand for any questions, and we'd really appreciate your support for the bill.
Members, any questions? Senator Lurie?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I support this, and it'll be going to finance, is my presumption, to get a fiscal note drafted. And just anyone who's watching and listening about the drafting, I mean, I think we thought we paid for a lot more of this last year than actually happened. So hopefully that's reflected in the fiscal note, that we didn't get very much of this in the rollout. I don't want to pay for it again.
Yeah, we got you.
Madam Chair, if I may,
Mr. Goodnow.
Senator Lurie makes a good point, and I believe the fiscal note was based off of the historical pattern of use in 2009 when none of these services were prior authed. So to put a fiscal note on saying you can't prior auth when the fiscal note was based on not doing it, I think it's a little bit odd, and would love to visit with you about that.
Have we seen a fiscal note? Well, we'll get into that.
Any other questions? Seeing none, Senator Hayden.
Madam Chair, I'd like to move Senate File 2637 as amended to the Committee on Finance.
On Senator Hayden's motion, any other question? Any other discussion? All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Motion passes.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. And Senator Hayden, Senate File 1692, Home and Community-Based Waiver and General Assistance Recipients, Residency Ratio Restrictions Modification. Senator Hayden.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I have Senate File 1692 is a good faith compromise between a broad spectrum of stakeholders, including NAMI Minnesota, the ARC Minnesota, the Disability Law Center, and the Mental Health Association of Minnesota. I do want to just pause at this point to say that though when we started this bill, it looks like those broad coalitions had agreement. Since that time, in the last last Friday, it looks like there has been some there has been some folks that I want to come forward to talk about some of the issues that they may have with the bill. And I just think it's important as we talk about this that this kind of was a peace in the valley, and it's an almost peace in the valley. So I just want to make sure that those that oppose it understand that I'm not trying to represent their interest. The bill does address unintended consequences in state law, which limits the number of people with disabilities who can choose to live in a getting setting, such as an apartment with other people with disabilities. Rather than a straight-out repeal of the limits, Senate File 1692 sets forth a thoughtful compromise exception process which allows only the best housing providers to move forward. Because of this compromise, if you will, to some extent, exceptions to the process allows for choice in housing, but also ensures integration, accountability, and quality. And I hope that I can get your support. So I know we're moving a little differently than before, so I just want to allow the testifiers who have come forward to testify.
Senator Hayden, there's an amendment. Have the delete all amendment at this time. It'll be distributed. Senator Hayden moves the A3 delete all author's amendment.
Yes.
All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? And Senator Hayden, do you wish to present
the amendment? Yeah, and I don't know if we're going to go in order or how we're going to start with our testifiers. I know we've had some additions.
I think it's up to you, Senator Hayden. Who do you wish to have go first?
We'll start with Zach Johnson.
Yep. First of all, can everybody hear me all right?
Yes, please introduce yourself for the record and state your name.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Zachary Johnson, and I'm here as an a tenant of a apartment building that also provides 24-hour personal care attendant service. I'm in support of this bill because I choose to have that 24-hour personal care attendant service because it allows me to what I would call live on society's time, meaning do spur-of-the-moment things like come and testify in front of this committee. Well, getting my intermittent cares done, meaning, and by intermittent care, I mean things like you can't predict when you have to go to the bathroom, or if you get sick in the middle of the night, the regular personal care attendant program is not designed to deal well with those that need intermittent care. So this is a better option for me. I feel that it allows me to be more integrated into the community because I can choose employment options not based on when my PCA can put me to bed, but when my employer needs me to come to work. This option allowed me to get my degree from the University of Minnesota and complete those 11 or 12 a.m. term papers that you need to turn in, which many of you probably understand are unavoidable. And I did not have to make the decision, should I finish this term paper or go to bed? Because that's the decision I would have to make under normal circumstances. And knowing me, I would have probably chose not to go to bed. So with that, I would ask your support for this bill and open it to any further questions. And I would also like to add that although the housing and the services can be provided together, I can choose to separate them at any time and not lose my housing. I want to make that perfectly clear to the committee that you can choose to separate housing and services at any time, meaning I could go on to the regular personal care attendant program at any time and not lose my housing. And with that, I'd open it to further questions.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Thank you very much for coming today to testify for us. Do you have another testifier, Senator Hayden?
Absolutely.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for the opportunity to speak today. My name is Chuck Peterson, and I serve as the Executive Director of Clare Housing and Chairperson of the Coalition for Choice in Housing. We're a diverse, growing coalition of tenants, advocates, individuals, and providers who believe that Minnesotans with disabilities deserve to have meaningful choice in housing. Our membership includes over 25 organizations that collectively provide affordable housing and supportive services to thousands of Minnesotans each year. We're here today to seek your support of House File 1990, or, I'm sorry, Senate File, which addresses some of the unintended impacts of Minnesota Statute 256B. After months of productive dialogue with a full spectrum of stakeholders, including NAMI Minnesota, the ARC Minnesota, Mental Health Association, and the Disability Law Center, we come before this committee, which what many have described as peace in the valley. At the heart of our compromise is an exception process to the existing statute, which you have before you today. We feel strongly the time to act on this legislation is now, because the existing statute creates confusion and uncertainty for both tenants and providers, as it is not being enforced uniformly, if at all. Tenants fear they may lose their home, and providers are being potentially faced with denying housing based on an individual's disability or if they are a recipient of a waived service. Second, at a time when there is substantial demand for quality housing options, some private market landlords are reluctant to continue working with us that offer scattered site housing due to the continued confusion and enforcement and fear of not being in compliance with the existing statute. Third, private and public financing is at risk and at times being denied or delayed. And finally, the existing statute is in conflict with both the Olmstead Plan and the recent release of CMS rules around home and community-based services, where notably arbitrary limitations, including a blanket ban on disability complexes, were studied and rejected. I'd like to take just a moment to describe and use Claire Housing, the organization I work for, as an example. We provide a continuum of supportive housing options for chronically homeless, very low-income people living with HIV and AIDS. Many have a dual diagnosis, including chemical dependency, mental illness, or a physical disability, in addition to strong criminal background histories. We own and operate and lease a total of 115 units, which include scattered site housing, two apartment buildings that allow for assisted living, and four community care homes where we provide 24/7 support. A research study we conducted 3 years ago demonstrates that providing stable housing and appropriate supportive services in a single-site setting, our residents had increased access to consistent intake of food and nutrition. We saw increased access to care, increased HIV medication adherence. We saw decreases in HIV viral loads, decreases in unnecessary emergency room visits and hospitalizations, increased feeling of safety and security, and improved mental health. We found that our research aligns with national research conducted by the National AIDS Housing Coalition that clearly demonstrates how appropriate housing options for an individual can reduce the overall public cost through improved health outcomes, reduced emergency and health inpatient services, criminal justice involvement, and other crisis costs. And specifically for people living with HIV, it can prevent new infections and save over $300,000 in lifetime medical costs. We believe our model is cost-effective. It demonstrates positive results, has a high level of satisfaction from tenants, and ultimately reduces the overall cost to the public. If Claire Housing was forced to comply with the existing statute, many of our residents would be forced back onto the streets, into emergency shelters, transitional housing, or nursing homes. At a time when we have a waiting list of over 200 people, compliance would mean denying housing based on their HIV status. In addition, health outcomes would decline, and the cost to our state and communities would increase over time. We as a coalition are not saying that our model of housing and supportive is the right solution for everyone. What we are saying is that we want the state to support a broad continuum of quality housing options for people living with disabilities. We believe the process we have outlined in the bill before you is consistent with CMS rulings, the Minnesota Olmstead Plan, and is the right solution for Minnesota. Over the course of several months of respectful dialogue, we've arrived at a thoughtful compromise that we feel is the right solution at the right time for people in Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you. And your next testifier?
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and Senators. My name is Ann Fox. I am the parent of a young man with developmental disabilities who lives in an apartment in Apple Valley. He's lived there since the building was open over 10 years ago. There are 15 other people living in the building where he lives, each in his or her own apartment. These 16 apartments are each home to a person with a developmental disability. All the residents live independently with varying levels of support in the community for both work and participation in the community from a variety of providers. Eric was very young at the time when the promise of Medicaid home and community-based waivered services became a reality for people with developmental disabilities. He and our family have benefited greatly his entire life from these services. We've advocated for him for years, for him and for others to be fully included in their communities. He attended fully inclusive schools, everything from a Montessori preschool through public education in two different districts to attending and receiving a certificate from Dakota County Community College. We don't want to turn back the clock. But we also believe that there are environments in which most or all of the people can have disabilities, but where they're fully included in their communities. Eric works competitively in his neighborhood. He walks to work. He shops at the local stores and participates in activities in his community. He comes and goes independently from his apartment, has his lease, pays his rent every month. His schedule is not regimented by apartment owners or by staff. In short, his living setting meets all the spirit of the CMS requirements of a community-based setting, except the arbitrary number of 25%. We invite you to visit him. He enjoys company. You can come anytime, but you'll have to ring the doorbell to let you in. And you should know that you might see dirty dishes in his sink. And if it's 8 o'clock at night, he might be watching TV and eating dinner. But if you come really late, he'll probably still be up because he's a night owl. Or if it's in the morning, he might be walking in the walking path in his neighborhood. Because, you see, you'll be visiting Eric not in an institution or in a setting, but in his home. So I ask for your support of this bill so that Eric and others like him can have their homes along with the waivered services that allow them to stay there. Thank you, and I would certainly welcome any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Fox. And one more testifier.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Ben Ashley Wertman. I represent the Mental Health Association of Minnesota, and for 75 years we've represented better lives for Minnesotans living with mental illnesses. I have been working together with my colleagues with the ARC Minnesota, NAMI Minnesota, and Minnesota Disability Law Center. We initially had significant concerns about the idea of changing the 25% cap. It is a blunt but valuable tool that moves us towards more integrated settings over the spectrum of housing options. And we have a responsibility to provide those settings under the CMS regulations under the Olmstead Plan. And the other concern that we had was that integrated buildings provide a natural and organic sense of quality control. When there are other people coming in and out of the building, they're able to report problems, they're able to let other people know that something is going on if there is a poor housing situation developing. Oftentimes, persons with disabilities feel that they are trapped in a housing situation that they may not have other options. Those were our concerns. Through the process, we were able to come to a thoughtful exemptions process, and I will spare you the details. Sean from Disability Law Center and Ethan Roberts from Jewish Services should be able to answer any of those questions, but I wanted to outline a couple of the key factors that we argued for and believe that make this bill deserving of your support. It promotes that sense of integration while allowing some flexibility for certain providers that are high quality. Providers will be incentivized to do what they do well. One of the concerns that we had is that we didn't want housing providers forced out of their lane and starting to provide services that that weren't right for them, but we did want to be able to reward the providers who could really move into those scattered site options. It'll hold providers to quality standards that make sense for the population that they'll be serving. We'll make sure that the relevant parts of DHS will be at the table to be able to turn away bad apples without barring the kinds of providers that we want serving Minnesotans with disabilities. And finally, it has provided a platform for advocates and residents to have an opportunity to comment on each exemption as it goes forward. There will also be a stakeholder process to be able to finalize out the details of this process. I hope you'll all actually believe me when I say that I genuinely look forward to that stakeholder process. When we first came to the table, things we didn't have a good understanding of each other. Through this process, we have built a lot of trust, we built a lot of understanding, and identified areas of shared concern. I think we're going to be able to make this tool into a really thoughtful way of providing flexibility and quality for Minnesotans with disabilities. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Senator Hayden, did you have any other?
Well, no, Madam Chair, I think those were the testifiers that I had, and I think there may be others maybe in that aren't so concerned that don't think this is the greatest idea in the world. Let's just say that.
Are there any questions that the committee members have? Senator Hoffman.
Madam Chair, thank you. Great use of flexibility, nice use of collaborative action. I would like to know how we're going to assure, and again, I'm going to reiterate, you did it right. You brought peace in the valley. You got folks that all have something at stake here. And I do too, not just as an elected official, but personally. And so I look at this and I'm wondering what's going to, there's always this kind of question of a slippery slope or a backdoor way to all of a sudden create situations where we have state institutions again. I mean, I'm getting sweaty thinking about it. So I help me understand and help me be so assured. And I can tell you when you get the Disability Law Center involved and you got folks involved that really care about this, I know that that's not going to happen. But then again, we all thought Hadamer wouldn't happen. We all thought other things wouldn't happen, and it did. So how can you assure us that we're not going to slide back into what's easy for us as policymakers to do something, but what we're doing is the right thing? And what I see you guys are doing is the right thing, and I applaud you for that. Really do. Especially, again, the collaboration effort that's there. So I guess it's more of a cautionary end on my part, saying make sure that we're not leaving any back doors open for people to say, let's go ahead and put up this 40-bed facility and call it a day. So, and granted, Olmsted of 1999 tells us we can't do that, but still, just make sure that that's there. And that's a caution I have from this table. And I really, again, Nancy, you guys, I applaud you for what you did on bringing peace in the valley on this. So good job, Senator Hayden.
Thank you.
So I do have a couple other names on the list that wish to testify. Alice Hulbert and Chris Bell, if you could come to the table.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Chris Bell, and I am testifying on behalf of the American Council of the Blind of Minnesota. Thank you for the opportunity to testify in this bill. I personally understand why it is that people with disabilities want to live with people who have like disabilities. And part of that reason is that in interactions with the general society who does not have disabilities, there are a lot of issues. And it's easier to live with people who understand disability, disability culture, disability etiquette. And for example, I live in Roseville, very close to the Harmar Mall. And very frequently, I will be walking outside of that mall, and some well-intentioned, well-meaning person will say, "Go right." Now, this person has no idea where I'm going, and when I sort of politely challenge him, "Well, how do you know where I'm going?" He says, "Well, aren't you going to the grocery store?" "No, actually, I'm not." But I understand that this person assumes that because I'm blind and he's sighted, he can tell me which way to go. Right? So that's an example of the kinds of problems that people with blindness face. So I get why people with disabilities want to live together, and I have no problem with that. I'd like to narrow the issue down. It's not about denying people the support services and the medical services that they need to live as independently as they can. That's not what this is about. It's not even about permitting disability-specific housing, because that's been permitted under the Fair Housing Act for years. It's been permitted under the Americans with Disabilities Act for years, and it's been going on. It's been funded, so there's no problem with that. The only problem that I have with this bill is that as it is written now, the sky is the limit as to how large these dwelling facilities can be. Can we build a 500-unit, five-story building only for people with disabilities? Can we build 1,000 units? There's nothing in this bill that provides a limitation. And there's nothing in the bill that provides a limitation on DHS's authority to make this exemption. And so, first of all, in principle, I have a problem with granting government, local, state, or federal, unlimited power to make broad exceptions like this one. I have a concern also that there's nothing in this bill that really addresses the issue of disability-segregated housing in terms of geography. There are places in Minnesota, I'm told, in the Twin Cities area, where you can find many or a majority of houses on the block are group homes. Are we going to permit people, operators of group homes, et cetera, not only build unlimited larger additions, but also to put them right next to each other so that we get, in effect, a kind of disability ghetto? So I don't think the people who are in favor of this legislation intend that. I don't think they want that. I think it was a great process, but I think there has to be some outside limitations, both with regard to the number of units that an operator of disability-only housing can build and as to their placement. My last point, which is very minor, is I would like to see in the process that DHS must go through in terms of consulting stakeholders. Right now, the principal agency in that is the Department of Human Services, which makes perfect sense. But the Department of Human Services has one kind of licensing that they do for these facilities. The Department of Health also must license these facilities. And in fact, I spoke with Alex Bartolik over the weekend. She's the Director of Disability Services at DHS. And she says that right now, DHS will inspect some facilities and apply also the housing, the health department standards. And the health department will do some dwellings and apply not only their standards, which are more physical in nature in terms of the structure and fire and all that kind of stuff, and DHS standards. So they coordinate. But MDH is not in this bill. And because MDH does license these facilities and does issue citations on these facilities, personally I think it's important that they be included. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'll take any questions you like.
Thank you, Mr. Bell. Senator Hayden?
Madam Chair, and I am appreciative of Mr. Bell's testimony. I do want to make the committee known that I think that the issues that he raises are important, but they not all of them are germane to, or pertaining. We don't have germane as a committee, but aren't pertaining to this bill per se. And so I will continue to work with Mr. Bell. I think these issues about, you know, the size and where they're located are things that we should continue to be looking at. I just don't know if all of those things, and though I appreciate him and I'm not saying he's wrong, just don't know if it's what we were trying to get at with this bill. But that being said, I do appreciate Mr. Bell for him coming to me and raising some of these questions.
Thank you. We've got one more testifier listed, and we'd like to finish this bill prior to adjourning this afternoon, so we just would like to keep it concise, and please introduce yourself for the record.
Hi, my name is Alice Hulbert. I'm the parent of a 29-year-old young man with disabilities who's living in the community. I'd just like to let everybody know that just because you have peace in the valley doesn't mean there's peace beyond the valley. We don't live in the valley. We didn't know this was going on. And a lot of families have really big concerns about the loopholes that will allow institutions to come back. We need to make sure that this bill creates a system where we can't see history repeating itself again. And the way it's written right now, the door is wide open. I think the concerns that Mr. Bell has brought up about the size is extremely important. It's very germane to this bill because potentially, and I've talked to the proponents and they agree, we have the ability to build unlimited size of dormitory-style apartments. Well, not apartments, dormitories for people with disabilities. I'd like to say that I don't think this committee would be considering putting people, perhaps welfare recipients, into dormitory settings. It's substandard housing, and I think to begin with, that should be restricted. I mean, Zach's apartment at least has got a sink to put dishes in, and Ann Fox's son has got a door. It's not a dorm room. So I think there are significant loopholes to do with the physical plant and the size of these places. I mean, we have a tainted model from the past that we have to be sure we're not going to start over again. My other concerns are, I'm on the State Quality Council. I've been working in areas of quality for several years now. The quality assurance plan that they have with this is non-existent. There is a one-time application. There's no follow-up. There's no any sort of ongoing inspection or quality assessment. The criteria that they have for having a provider that they have recognized quality standards. News to you guys, we don't have recognized quality standards yet in the state of Minnesota. We're working on that in the State Quality Council, but have not got funding to proceed. We have licensing, but all licensing can do is provide the base level of acceptable standard. It doesn't mean quality. And I've heard that over and over in our meetings. We don't have quality yet. We have base level standards. So that whole premise that we're only letting qualified providers, high quality providers, is a fallacy. We need to be more careful in the way that this is done. I think the legislative intent is unclear. I know nobody here wants the institutions to come back, and I think the legislation needs to reflect that we're not going to let the institutions come back. So my suggestions would be that we allow existing settings. I don't want to throw Ann Fox's son out on the street or Zach out on the street. Existing successful programs need to be able to apply and continue to function. But new programs need to be limited in the number of people and the number of programs. When I presented that to proponents, they said, well, we don't want to have to compete with each other. But you know what? I like competition. We're talking 1 year. I don't know what the harm is in saying existing programs apply, you're in. New programs, if you're 50 or less, apply. If you're over 50 beds, we need to talk about that, and we need to limit this, and we need to create a funding stream to support quality assurance so that standards for the community can be developed for larger settings. We don't have standards for large settings. We got rid of them, we thought. There's still 300 people in institutions waiting to move out 25 years after we said we're closing institutions. It takes a really long time to unwind big systems. So I think if we're moving back to the potential for big systems, we need to go about it just as carefully. I think the exception process is a good idea. We do need the ability to have some of those types of specialized settings, but the unlimited expansion that can occur with this is not reasonable. In Hennepin County, there were only 38 new waiver slots last year. So why people want to authorize unlimited expansions of beds doesn't make any sense. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Hulbert. Senator Lurie.
Any questions? I'm sorry.
Senator Lurie.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to Senator Hayden, I did confer with you briefly and let you know that I do applaud all the work that has been done to bring a lot more consensus around this issue, but that I do, too, share many of the concerns with the last two testifiers and that Senator Hoffman was beginning to express.
and think that this may not be quite ready. One, you know, and from the fiscal side of the House, I mean, I need to say you give DHS this broad authority, the type of setting that's unlimited and maybe not as quality housing is a lot cheaper to provide. And, you know, that's a hard thing to talk about, but I think we need to. And if we open this up and offer this as a tool without additional legislative oversight and a tool that is much more efficient financially to deliver, we may be biting off more than we anticipate right now. So, I mean, I don't at all mean to say that that's what anybody is working toward right here, but I think that we're putting in statute something that could allow that and that financial considerations could come to play down the road, and we don't have anything in this statute to prevent that much more economic, you know, option from occurring, and it troubles me, and I will be voting no. I mean, I think that you've probably got enough support here to pass this along, and I'm willing to continue to do that. That, in addition with the fact that DHS, to the best of my knowledge, really doesn't have a complete understanding of these new home and community-based rules that have come out of CMS. I think that a little bit of time to digest those rules as they come out of CMS and get better understood, you know, when we come back next year, it might be a much better time to undertake something like this. And I, too, am very sympathetic to the ones that have grown in today's environment and think we should find some way to make sure we preserve those, but allow for a better understanding of the rules from CMS and make sure that we have the proper safeguards to ensure that we're not biting off more than we understand today.
Senator Hayden.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and Senator Lori, and you did prior to the committee tell me that there may be some of those issues. And so though I know that we've been busy and trying to get these things done and they're coming by fast, I do think that there has been a really good faith effort, and some of these guys want to get in to talk about that, about trying to figure these issues out. I think that this issue is broad and unwieldy, and to some extent there are issues that are coming into play that aren't necessarily this issue per se, but is something that most people care about. I think that what I think a better way of doing this personally is to continue to, honor the tradition of folks really coming together who have been thoughtful and leaders in this legislature around helping us think about these issues. And if there are other concerns or loopholes or things that we think might not happen, that we continue to work those things out as they head to your committee. However, I think to stop this now, frankly, would take a lot of people. And once again, I know that we are just not always able to get every single person that cares. And I told the advocates, those that are not in favor of this bill, what I found out Friday and then Sunday and then this morning, we had a brief meeting that I understand that it's just sometimes hard to do that as people are working and taking care of their families, and that's why they're here today. But I do think that this is a an ability for us to move forward, and though there are always something could happen, there's some smart person or some nefarious or bad actor that could find a backdoor way. I mean, I think we take that each and every day that we try to make the best decisions. And so I don't want the fear of, every hole not being buttoned up stop us from continuing to make progress. For the people who we've heard today, that do want to live in a setting that is supportive and that may be headed towards the streets if we don't do something, that's a very real possibility as well. And I think that we need to understand that, and we need to not discount that. And what I'm trying to do, and what I think the coalition has been trying to do, Senator Lori, Madam Chair, is to find the proper balance. And if this isn't it, I think we might be close. And I think it would be, I would ask my colleagues to help me to move this forward with the full understanding that we will continue to have these discussions with the department and also understand and take a look at the fiscal impacts one way or the other. I think that that's really important.
Senator Hayden, there's two people who have joined you at the table. If they have, I'm sorry, Senator Lori.
Madam Chair, consider this when we get additional testimony here. But you know, I think you probably do have the support, even without my vote, to move it to the next committee. If you don't, if you think you need my vote, I mean, I probably could support, in that spirit, a motion to move it on without recommendation. I have significant discomfort with this. I do think there's things that need to be done, but I probably could support a motion to move it without recommendation. I do applaud the work that's been done. So you can think about that, and maybe we can get.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, and I mean, Madam Chair, and Senator Lori, I didn't particularly count, and you know, I just thought that, you know, based on the work that had been done and the folks that were at the table, that we had covered most of the significant challenges that people would have. So I'm not sure it is headed to your committee if we are to get it done. So that means that we will, you know, continue to have, with your concern, a lot of conversation about this. I appreciate you wanting to put on the record your concerns about it. I think if we can get some brief testimony from our testifiers, and then I know that we're anxious to move forward.
Senator Hoffman, do you want to speak right now, or do you want to wait until we have?
Madam Chair, thank you. It's a process question. I think Senator Lori brings up a really good point, so I'll wait till the testimony is done before I ask.
So we have two people at the table. If you could keep your testimony really, really, really brief, because we only have a very few minutes and we need to move on.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Sean Burke. I'm an attorney at the Disability Law Center. I briefly just want to reply to Senator Hoffman's question, comment, and Senator Lori as well. Please assure me that we're not going back. And I just want to give the committee, and Senator Lori brought this up, but real briefly, two things to think about when we're talking about today's piece of legislation. Number one, what we're talking about is the definition of a home and community-based setting, so a place that someone's going to be able to live, and a provider will be reimbursed for providing them Medicaid services, home and community-based waiver services specifically. So CMS has come out with a rule just this January, as Senator Lori said, about this definition. And their rule provides a lot of the baseline protections that Senator Hoffman, that we're worried about. it's person-centered rule. There has to be robust person-centered planning. So it looks at the person. There has to be a choice in housing, not just this choice and this choice, but among a variety of options. There is a quality component. There are assurances for individual lease and places. In short, it is a culmination of 5 years of CMS taking into a lot of input, things like providers and advocates alike have told them to consider. The second point is what they left out or what they didn't define. What they didn't do in that rule is they didn't have a cap, like a 25% limitation in a building, or even a hard number cap, as we heard today. They're letting that up for the states. So really what is in front of us as a state is, how are we going to define settings? Are we going to go even above and beyond and put on a few extra restrictions to ensure that in Minnesota, in some ways, we're even more progressive when it comes towards integration? And the policy debate is about the efficacy of the 25% tool. It's really a concentration limit. As was already said, we believe that the tool is valuable, but as it currently stands, it's simply too sharp and too harsh a tool. So the compromise process has been, how do we find a way to leave this tool in place but provide for the exceptions when we really need it? And that's the policy debate, is how to keep concentration limits that no other state has in their actual Medicaid definition of a setting, this hard cap. So it's up to us in Minnesota to decide, let's keep a concentration limit, but let's make it sensible. So just to remember that a lot of those protections that we're worried about are already going to be put in place by the feds. They already are in place. We're going to have to come into compliance with that. Our whole goal with this piece is, how are we going to do the concentration limit policy sensibly? And with that, I'll turn it over to Sue Abderholden from NAMI, Minnesota.
Ms. Abderholden.
Madam Chair, members, Sue Abderholden with NAMI, Minnesota. You know, when we first started closing the institutions, the goal was to have everyone with a serious mental illness in their own apartment. You know, I'm reaching 60, and I have never lived alone. And so for that to be a goal doesn't really make sense. And a lot of people with a serious mental illness or symptoms have them really isolate a lot and not know how to reach out. Many of them, you know, they have the highest unemployment rate. We don't have day training, rehabilitation, or anything like that. We have found over the years that trying to develop different options is really helpful. As many of you know, corporate foster care can be just as institutionalized as having a small building with, you know, 15 apartments where we're doing supportive housing. People get checked on. They get to talk with other people. Someone's, you know, talking with them daily can be really helpful. We thought very carefully about how to move forward on this issue. I think, you know, probably of all the groups, what happens to too many of my folks is they end up homeless. And so this housing issue and how we provide the services is really important. I think an exception process is better than just saying we're going to put a cap on this number of apartments, because we really want to look at who that provider is. If you've been to Touchstone's new building, you will, I mean, it's a beautiful building. They've thought of everything in terms of even how light impacts people's depression. I mean, they've looked at all those things. If they were going to do another thing and they laid out those same plans, I would be like, thank you, that would be great. So I understand these are difficult issues. No one knows more than me about how we have to, you know, finesse this very carefully. You know, there might be some more, you know, tinkering and issues to address. I don't want another family style where, yeah, people were had their own houses with two or three people in them, but they took up the whole block. You know, that's not a right thing to do either, and that's something that I think, you know, would be certainly good to look at. But I, too, don't want this just stopped. I think we should move forward and continue to address people's concerns. But I do think that the compromise really did address a lot of our concerns. Thank you.
Thank you. Members, any further questions? Senator Hoffman?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Beck, you got halfway there on answering my question. I would have liked to hear that the ombudsman is involved with this. Ann Henry is making sure that nothing is going on. I mean, I would have liked to hear that kind of response, because you're right. Choice in housing is one thing and no other state. And when you said no other state, it reminds me of Texas, who once had Cabbage Patch Kids. That's what they had. They had children in state institutions, and that's what they referred to them as. Don't ask. Bonnie Jean Smith will be the first to tell you about that. I have a list of what other states are doing. And I like what we're doing here, but I'm still not convinced. That's why I'm liking what Senator Lori is talking about, is moving this on, but let's make sure that those specific points are assured. Because when you open up that little door and nobody's being an advocate for it, that's why I don't see the ombudsman on here at all. I don't see her name any through this at all. If you don't have somebody there that's asking those questions, then pretty soon we got another mess on our hands. And I'd rather be proactive and really listen to what Senator Lori's saying about moving this without recommendation, and then with a continuation that you're going to work on this and that you're going to make sure that I'm not sitting here wondering where the assurances are. I love what you're doing. You did the right thing. You collaborated. You did everything. There's a yeah but here for me, and I can't get over that yeah but. So
Madam Senator Chair, to Senator Hoffman and Senator Lori Sincere, and I guess I would reiterate that I think that there has been a good faith effort, as you said. There has been collaboration. I don't think that the group will stop listening and collaborating as all of these stakeholders have come together. If there needs to be an addition to, as for the ombudsman and the negotiations with them, if we need to clearly identify, you know, what this bill does, I think it's important. And then if there are these other issues which are real that we need to talk about in terms of placement and how big, that, which doesn't deal with this, I think that those are opportunities for us to move those forward. I would love to do that, but Senator Hoffman, I think we know that you are much more adept to some of these issues, and I'd love to work with you if I can be helpful to deal with those. But as we move forward, if it is the committee's pleasure, I think that some of those things that give you a greater assurance and a little less anxiety, we're more than willing, at my commitment, to work for it. In addition, if it does go forward, it does go to Senator Lori's committee, who has some issues, and I'm sure that we can continue to work with the committee chair as we hear this bill. So with that being said, I'm not sure, Madam Chair, if there's more or should we move the bill?
I think we need to move the bill. And Senator Hayden, your motion?
So I guess my motion would be to move Senate File 62 as amended to finance.
Any further discussion or comments? Okay. All those in favor of Senator Hayden's motion, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Motion passes.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
And the meeting is adjourned.
John.